Welcome back to Pure POV, the Pulse on Medicine, a podcast series by Physicians Weekly, showcasing the latest insights from your peers across the medical community. In the first part of their conversation, Drs. Alex McDonald and Carl Lambert discuss practical ways for physicians to better support patients with developmental disabilities.
Welcome, everyone, to today's Physicians Weekly chat. I'm very excited. I mean, I'm always excited for our guests, but I'm particularly excited for this guest. We have Dr. Carl Lambert joining us today. So, Dr. Lambert, welcome to the podcast. Tell us who you are and what you do.
Yeah, great to join you. It's great to see you as well. So I am a family physician. So I'm in the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine here at Rush Medical College in Chicago, where I get to wear a lot of different hats. I'm mainly in undergraduate medical education. So I have a lot of time as a clinician educator with our first through fourth years. I lead a four-year family medicine leadership program for interested students. I direct our service learning content and community service aspect, which is a draw for Rush. I'm a part of our admissions executive committee, so I get to review and vote and select applicants to shape our medical school class. And I'm also a faculty advisor for SNMA, which tends to be a group for mainly our African-American students, just to have a safe space and just to brainstorm ideas to just represent the ideals that they have for the larger just medical community. So those are just some of the few hats that I have.
You wear a lot of hats, and even for a family doctor, that's a lot of hats. I mean, and that's sure. And I'm saying that, so you know it's got to be a lot. So
yeah. That tends to be the trend for us. You know, we just tend to juggle a lot. You know.
Yeah. Well, I like to say, you know, family physicians, we do lots of things, and lots of things keep us happy and fulfilled. And so as a result, we have lots of tools and skills to help our patients and our healthcare systems overall. So, but I'm biased. Tell me a little bit about you personally, also, because we're going to kind of delve into this a little bit farther again as a Black man in medicine. I think there's some unique challenges and stories that we can share. And then also as a father. So tell me a little bit about your personal life too, if you wouldn't mind sharing.
Sure. Yeah. Where to start? So I'll start with family. So I'm the oldest of three kids. So I'll be 41 this year. And I got two younger brothers who happen to both be on the spectrum. We're diagnosed with autism at an early age. Two loving parents who my brothers still live with them. Mm-hmm. Dad, he used to work Kraft General Foods and was at CTA, Chicago Transit Authority, and worked really hard to provide for us. My mom was a TA for many years and really worked with special needs kids. Mm-hmm. So I found myself at an early age kind of feeling like a third parent, if you will. So like helping with some of the cares of my brothers, in some ways kind of learning some of the ideals of what we think about as a physician, like advocacy, caring for people who may not be able to care fully for themselves, those who are vulnerable, and just having some sort of a curiosity about what makes people tick. And ironically, mm-hmm. some of the care they got was at Rush. Kind of a full circle experience to be faculty here. Actually, some of their specialist care was at Rush back in the day. And yeah, I just kind of remember admiring the physicians and how they care for my brothers. Like, it wasn't stigmatized. They just kind of treat us as regular folks, mm-hmm. you know? And I think that was one of the first instances where I thought like, hey, I think I kind of like this combination of using science, but also like having a humanistic side, connecting with people to help solve problems and build relationships over time. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was probably one of my first experiences. Was like, well, you know, I think I could probably do this doctor thing. So that's past. Present, you know, as far as family life, you know, it's me and my wonderful wife, Adrian. She is a therapist. Okay. I'm probably her worst patient or client, you know? And yeah, we've married for, this will be 13 years. We've known each other for about 20 years almost. And we have two kids. My son, Isaac, he will be 5 in August. And my daughter, Naomi, she's 3. She turned 3 in March. So they keep our lives very colorful and busy. And I'll add that my son, Isaac, and you know this, you know, I put a lot of this on social media. So he's had quite a health and just kind of a medical journey with him. Mm-hmm. So he's born very premature at about 27 weeks. I had a birth that was complicated by needing a trach for several years. He was decannulated. Mm-hmm. And also a diagnosis of level 2, level 3 autism. So mm-hmm. nonverbal, G-tube fed, and just a myriad of just things that has challenged me, not just as a physician, but just like as a medical parent. Yeah. Right. And I think that's even informed more some of the work that I do in family medicine. So that's just a little bit of the personal, not everything, but we can delve in more if you like, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. And I think that's a great example of sort of your past and your lived and your current experiences sort of shape who you are and professionally kind of where your career goes and how you help kind of fill that gap. I know particularly people with autism and other developmental disabilities often are caught up in a dysfunctional healthcare or sorry, dysfunctional disease care system, if you will. And for you, I guess for you as a physician and as a parent and as a brother of those with special needs and health medical needs, like how do you fill that gap and how do you help other physicians or patients understand how to kind of fill that gap that clearly exists?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I've been reckoning with that. You know, I think the first thing is just like to just care, just to start caring about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something I can even tell like my graduating med students, like, don't forget to care. Like and I think as family physicians, we get this, like we can do a little bit of everything, but you find that there's a couple of just different things that just kind of pull your heartstrings that you're just kind of drawn to certain populations, right? Or they will just find you, you know? So that's kind of what happened at Rush. So for instance, Rush, we have in what's called the Art Center. So that's an autism assessment research and training center, right? Oh, wow. Mainly run by psychology, psychiatry, neurology. It's a whole, you know, whole thing. I even had my son diagnosed there, but I would over the years just take patients, you know, say, hey, we just need someone who will be a primary care doctor for them, particularly when there's this, what we call a transitional cliff after pediatric care is done. Mm-hmm. After that, it's the wild, wild west, right? Yeah. You don't know what could happen to these adults with intellectual disabilities. You know, they could go without just basic stuff that you and I may take for granted, just regular preventative care, mm-hmm. or they can be ostracized. And there's just like huge disparities there where the life expectancy is far lower than other adults. It's a bit of a heartbreaking thing. So like, I think as an individual, that kind of prompted me to think about, well, how can I be a leader or quote unquote innovator, you know, with this? I think it's just being curious about like what's around you and what can you leverage to make things better. So this last year or so, my department, they had an opportunity to apply for a grant and you can do whatever you want to with this grant. And I said, you know what? I think what I want to do is I want to create what's called like a neuro-inclusive primary care clinic experience, right? In conjunction with the Art Center. So I said, hey, I see patients anyway, but it's usually like, they'll message me on Epic and it becomes just like not the neatest thing. And I'm just fitting them in. Why don't I create like a half day curated experience that's a little bit more organized and having like an assistant where we can actually integrate some of like standard neuro-inclusive care for them, right? So I think, you know, finding a cause, finding stakeholders and like aligning yourself with other people who are trying to do that work and just learning how to collaborate and even delegate well. So that was one arm of it, was just like, hey, finding a cadre of patients, going to referral sources, you know, talking to community here at Rush and just beyond like, hey, we have this thing. Here's what I'm looking for. Kind of almost using like my scholarly brain in ways that I would had not done before. It's like, okay, what are we, how are we defining patients in need? How are we narrowing this down? And then creating like a checklist or an onboarding list as far as like, what sort of accommodations do these patients need? Is that sensory? Is that mobility? Is that lighting? What's their form of communication? Is it AAC? How can we make sure that plans actually are carried out? Like just getting all that stuff up front, I found it a great way to care for this patient population. It's been greatly appreciated. Also having the opportunity to just teach, right? So I teach anyway, but having in services for faculty members and residents and medical students, and maybe even creating curriculum around that, have been some ways to do that. So I think that may partially answer your question. I'm not sure.
No, that, I mean, that's incredible. And talk about a way to truly be patient-centered and create a space that really caters to a lot of these different sort of needs of these, some of these patients that are typically not even, people aren't even aware of them. I mean, you mentioned the lighting. I mean, typically no one thinks about lighting in the clinical setting, right? But to really truly be patient-centered and create a place where those patients can all be helped is truly amazing. I love hearing this. And your piece about writing curriculum around this and teaching other people piques my interest. And I'll connect with you later because I want to steal some of that later for my own residents, honestly. But I digress. Well, help me understand that. So clearly you're very knowledgeable about this. You have sort of from a professional point of view, but how does being a physician with a child with autism kind of do you ever have to like turn off your doctor brain and just go into dad mode? Like, is there a challenge sometimes there between translating kind of professionally what you know versus personally? Because obviously we don't treat family members for a reason.
Right.
But do you ever have challenges with that? Just being a dad sometimes and not being a doctor.
Yeah, it was, yes, absolutely. I'd be lying if I said, no, I just have a clear delineation. Like, no, nobody ever says that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I think because of Isaac's stuff, you know, there were periods where we didn't even know if he was going to make it. So there were periods where I literally had to lean on the medical team. Like, this is beyond my expertise. Like, I really am trusting you guys. And that's been the care team that we've had really up to his point of life now. So we have a great relationship. It's been very collegial. And they will call me out. And my wife, my wife is like, she checks me so hard. She's like, look, I know you are a doctor, but you're not his doctor. But there's ways that it helps. Like, you know, I think his family docs were able to assess acuity. So I can be like, yeah, you don't need to go to a doctor for that. Or no, we should take him to the ER. You know, and most of the time they'll roll with me. But there's been instances where his PCP has had to say, Carl, we got to put him in. We got to admit him. Even if it's for a couple of hours, we got to do. So like there's a really good relationship where they hear me, but they're like, you're still dad. You have some medical knowledge that can help us to make the plan.
Mm-hmm.
But we have there's a track record where I've learned to trust them, where I've been given permission to kind of take off some of that armor. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To just be dad. And sometimes that's just really all that matters the most. It's just to hold your child, just to be present, not to, you know, log on up to date or whatever, but really let someone else do that.
Right.
So I think it was tougher in earlier days.
Yeah.
Now there is, you know, and it's morphing, like needs change. And now discussions are more so with the schools as opposed to like his medical team. He's not as complex as they define it.
Sure.
Now it's just navigating like therapies and ABA and all that stuff. That's kind of what we've been doing lately.
And how old is he now?
So he'll be 5 in August.
5 in August. Okay. Yep. Yeah. So definitely getting into the school age range where there's a whole nother realm of systems to work with. Right. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Did your experience as a brother with children with autism kind of shape your not only your experience going into medicine, but then your experience as a father and helping your other children kind of navigate, you know, life with a neurodivergent brother also?
Yeah, I think it has helped me certainly as an advocate. Like, I do get a little prickly when I hear folks use words that I wouldn't necessarily use to describe folks with autism. There's certain stigmatizing words. So I will often be one to kind of correct. You know, I think that I guess that's in a way like this could be being an upstander, you know, if you will. So I definitely have become more comfortable doing that and kind of just standing up for people in that realm when there's some miseducation going around.
Yeah.
I think even in the current form where I guess earlier in the year, there's a lot of talk about autism and, you know, not to get political, but just like there was just certain messaging around what causes autism, what doesn't, what is the capability of people with autism. There's even this discourse around like people with autism will never have a job or yada, yada, yada. So, you know, even using our space using my space as a clinician to kind of call it out and just kind of push back against things online or in person, and certainly making sure my learners are aware of this. Thankfully, I think a lot of folks are savvy already, but it never hurts to remind. And then there was one other thing that I was going to say, but I can't quite remember. I just left my head. We'll probably come back later, but
no worries. We can always jump back to it if you remember. What do you wish more physicians knew or understood or did regarding autism and, you know, meeting the needs of their neurodiverse patient population, and where can they learn more?
Yeah, a lot of my learning had kind of been on the go.
You know,
I would love to, you know, for instance, maybe through STFM, for instance, like create a toolkit or something around this. A lot of what I've learned is like just having buddies in psychiatry and stuff, and I just kind of borrow things from them. But certainly, you can read literature around this. There is, you know, there's things around this. I would want clinicians to know that it's not as intimidating as you think, because sometimes we'll see a patient with autism and the whole clinic just falls apart. It's like, oh, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be an anomaly. Like the clinic shouldn't fall apart. We should have the capabilities to treat them just like anybody else. It may just, I think the big thing I would push is that it may just require a little bit more planning in advance. Right. So again, like I really love that with our clinic, we're able to actually do a phone interview with the parent or caregiver or the patient about like, what are your needs? What are being the things that you liked or didn't like about past experiences and how can we mitigate that? And you'd be surprised how big of a deal that is in that population. Like, and also just streamlining, you know, the wait time to getting from room to the examination room, having, you know, not just the lighting, but having like a weighted blanket, fidget toys, headphones, just having that stuff in the clinic. And if you do a survey in advance, you can have that at the ready for the patients, right? So that it's not as scary as it would, as one would think. Another thing I was going to say is with patients with autism, to avoid what's called like clinical or diagnostic overshadowing. Sometimes patients come in with stuff and we're just like, well, it's the autism. When it could be just something clinical. It could be, you know, thyroid disease or sinus infection, right? So just keeping your differential broad and just think about it like you would with anybody else and not to just sandbag it to just like the underlying autism diagnosis or something.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I really appreciate you kind of calling that out, because we all kind of have our own diagnostic biases to help us sort of, you know, get through our day a little bit more efficiently. And so just having to recalibrate our kind of our diagnostic acumen a little bit and making sure that we're sort of checking our own biases at the door to the exam room, because I think we're all, you know, we're all biased. We all do it as a compensating mechanism just to get through our day a little bit more easily also. I think one thing is, I mean, really, do you do a lot of, clearly within your ARTS clinic or your autism clinic specifically, like you clearly do a lot of training for staff, I imagine. And I think that's one of the biggest barriers that I face is I have a couple of patients with autism and sometimes the staff just don't even know or don't even understand. And sometimes if I give them a heads up, like, hey, you know what, this patient's going to take a little more time to room them, pressure cuff when you put the blood, maybe we're going to skip the blood pressure today if they can't tolerate it. And just giving my LVN and my MA a kind of a heads up can be really, really helpful, because otherwise they're like fighting with it and you sort of get into this power struggle and nothing goes well. So that's, I think, just like, I love how you think about, you reach out to the patient and the family ahead of time to know, okay, what are their needs? But then also just kind of giving a heads up to our back office staff who maybe you're not as familiar with them. I've found that very effective.
Yeah, we huddle. And thankfully I tend to have like one to two MAs that I'm pretty regularly with where I'll say, hey, here's a copy of the intake form we got from the patient. Here it is. Do you have questions? Here's when they're going to come. I want this room. Like I want, you know, maybe the procedure room or a larger room where it's not as cramped. We can plan just what that'll look like, you know? And yeah, thankfully it's a smaller team. And we survey with the project, we survey the team to say like, hey, what's working for you? What isn't working for you? How can we improve this moving forward, you know, from their standpoint? So yeah, I agree with you.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned for next week's episode. To hear more, follow Peer POV, The Pulse on Medicine on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music.